Probably starting to get hungry now, so we might as well just begin. I'm going to follow on more or less directly from where Sophie left off, quite literally, because we've seen from her talk that you can determine whether or not somebody is being deceptive partially by measuring their total extent of their movement. Now, what we want to do is to follow up on this, because we consider that conversation is mostly something of a dynamic system. One person does something, the other person responds. Quite often that involves some extent of mirroring. What we wanted to know is, can we also determine whether or not somebody is being deceived from looking at their movement when they're talking to somebody who is deceiving them? The practical advantage to this, potentially, is that you could use this sort of measurement in situations where you can't necessarily suit somebody up into an XSENS or watch them in a Kinect or whatever comes next with the technology. So, for example, if you are a police officer interviewing a suspect in the police station, then that's absolutely fine. On the other hand, if you're a police officer who is out in the field taking witness statements from several different people, then you don't necessarily have the time to measure all of the people you're speaking to's movement. Similarly, if you're in the military and you're out on patrol, then you probably don't have the capacity to measure what the person you're doing is doing, but you can measure yourself. The other advantage, of course, you could do this much more discreetly. You've seen the XSENS as it currently is, with lots of wires hanging around, people are going to notice. The new generation of XSENS actually isn't so bad, it's got rid of the wires. So you can probably put this on underneath a suit, underneath your kit if you're in the military, and you can go out and you can measure these movements, and then you can potentially in the future will be able to, if we can observe these movements, give somebody a little buzz if the signals they're receiving or indicate that the person they're speaking to is being deceptive. And of course, it also just tells us theoretically, if we now look for the same types of movement in people who are being deceived as we observe in deceivers, that might tell us a little bit about how conversation works. So I can mostly just summarize this slide as what Sophie said, so I'll try and gloss over it a little bit. But when you're talking to someone, you're trying to decide if they're being deceptive. You're doing this to some extent consciously. You're trying to work out what's going on. But there's a lot of very low-level cues that you might pick up on non-consciously, which either never reach consciousness, or they do reach consciousness and you ignore them. You put them down to differences between cultures or people just being a little bit different. So you want to see if we can combine this top-down, I want to decide if I can believe what this person is saying, with the bottom-up, I'm displaying cues that indicate I'm being deceived and I may or may not be aware of that. So to do this, we had, I think, quite a fun experiment. So one of the ways we try to motivate people in our lab is not just with money. We try to get a very immersive environment so that they get into a particular role and they take it quite seriously that way. So we set up a lab to look a lot like a military base, or at least like a very stereotypical military base. So, you know, we had camouflage netting over the furniture and military history books in the bookshelves and war photography, and of course a picture of the Queen somewhere hidden away. And what we did is we asked our participants if they would play the role of a military investigator. So they had to solve one of four fictional crimes on our supposed military base. They had to work out where drugs were being exchanged, who had sabotaged some medical equipment, how engine parts were being smuggled off the base, or why somebody had broken into the personnel records. Now, obviously, our participants were not particularly well-trained military investigators, so to help them, we used picture cards, so that this would help to guide their questioning. It also somewhat simulates what happens in the real military, but there, of course, the picture cards tend to be used because people are often speaking in a second language, or at least they're talking to somebody who is speaking in their second language. And we also used the motion capture suits. I'll tell you a little bit about the precise measures we used, but we used exactly the same motion capture suits as Sophie used. And we also differentiate the people they were interviewing or interrogating. We monitored how cooperative we differed how cooperative they were, and we gave them different types of knowledge, and explain a little bit about that in a second. First of all, this is just a quick example of our picture cards. So the particular scenario they had here was that engine parts were disappearing from the base, and they'd searched all of the Army's own logistical trucks. They couldn't work out how they were getting off. So what the military do sometimes in these situations is they just bring in all of the local workers, all of the guys who work on the base, give them quick interviews and try and decide who they think might know more than they're letting on. So there was four potential ways that they thought these information might be disappearing. One is on the little local tuk-tuk type vehicles that the locals tend to drive on and off the base, the people who work on there. The other military vehicles, besides the big logistical trucks, the locals themselves, a lot of the deliveries are done by people who live in the countries, and they tend to have their own trucks. And the noble donkey, which is often underrated as a mode of transport and movement in when you've got mountainous regions and not necessarily the best roads. So people would have these posted on the wall, and they could point to them if they wanted to, say, you know, what would be the advantages of doing this? What would be the disadvantages? How plausible do you think this is? And like I said, the people they were interviewing were actually six of our either master's or PhD students. And what we'd asked them to do was to either cooperate as much as they could with the investigation, be as helpful as they could possibly be, or else, however they liked, try to get in the way of the investigation. But we also gave them three different types of knowledge. So they either didn't have any knowledge at all, so what we would do is we'd give everybody a basic amount of information about how the base worked, so that when they were getting asked questions, they could answer some of that. But some of them had genuine knowledge about the crime and some of them didn't. None of the people that were being interviewed were directly involved. The idea would be that they would have heard rumors going around. And this is how we can use the false knowledge to some extent as well. So, for example, the person who was cooperating and truthful, they would have genuine knowledge. They'd heard around the base, oh, I've heard that what they're doing is they're breaking down the engine parts and they're rebuilding them into the little tuk-tuks and driving them off because nobody's checking that the engines have extra parts on them. And the people who didn't have knowledge, if they're cooperating, then they would be saying, well, I'd love to help you, but honestly, I've never heard of it. I don't know what's going on. To simulate the false knowledge, what we would do is the guys who had knowledge about a particular crime, half the time when they got to come into the lab, we would just give them a surprise story that they wouldn't have been able to rehearse, so they didn't really have any evidence to back up what they were saying. So the idea would be, if you're cooperating, this would be somebody who's heard a rumor, but it's a false rumor, and they can't really substantiate it by knowing what's going on the base. And of course, if you're not cooperating, you've got this, then you're just overtly lying. You're trying to deliberately mislead the investigation. If you had the true knowledge and you weren't being cooperative, you would just be saying, no, I don't know what's going on. You would just completely blank them. And similarly, if you're not cooperating, you have no knowledge, essentially your response pattern is exactly the same. You're just saying no to everything. But you're not hiding any knowledge in that case. You're essentially just being unpleasant for the sake of it. So there are different conditions, essentially. And the idea would be that the person who is telling the truth, they're the most trustworthy. Least trustworthy is probably somebody who's actively trying to mislead the investigation. Then probably the person who could help but is refusing. Then the person who's probably just getting in the way. And it's probably tricky to say who is more or less trustworthy between somebody who is trying to help but giving misleading information and somebody who is trying to help but can't help at all, because either of those two people could just be a very good liar, and it's probably quite difficult to disambiguate that. Our participants, we had 40 of them, and because we are in a psychology department, they're almost exclusively very young and very female. We had done another study which had a bigger mix of both men and non-English students when we were sort of piloting this, and we found no real differences between them in terms of the pattern. We found that British men moved less than everybody else, but I think that says more about the dynamism of us rather than anything about anyone else. The pattern was exactly the same. We've seen this lady before today, haven't we? So to measure the non-verbal behavior, we used the accents as we've seen. In terms of extensive movement, all of the interviews were about 3 minutes long, give or take a couple of seconds. And to remove any effect of that couple of seconds, we just measured the amount of movement per second for all of the interview and then took the average. So that just meant if the interview was a couple of seconds longer, it didn't really make any difference. For movement erraticism, we wanted to measure this because there have been a few studies that suggest that people who are deceiving, their movement becomes slightly more erratic. So we wanted to see if this would also be translated into our people who are being deceived. So the way the extents basically works is about 120 times a second, it takes a measure of location. So all we're doing to get the total extent of movement is summing the total amount of movement in each frame for the second. To get the erraticism, all we're doing is looking at the variability within each second. So if somebody's moving quite consistently throughout the interview, essentially there's going to be a very small standard deviation. Whereas if somebody has some very quick movements followed by very slow movements, there's going to be a much larger standard deviation. And then finally, just because arms can move a lot more than heads, we had to account for the total amount of movement in each limb, so we just divided by the mean amount of movement in each limb. Does that sort of make sense? Just nod and smile, good. In terms of conscious measures, we also wanted to measure this. So we had a very standard trust measure of the trust game. So we gave our participants 30 hypothetical pounds. They were permitted to then split this 30 pounds between themselves and our six participants however they liked. Anything they chose to donate would be multiplied by 3. And the idea would be that the person they donated to could choose to send however much money of that they wanted back to the donor. So the idea being that there's nothing stopping them just taking the money and running if they want, but if you think somebody's going to be nice and helpful, then they're going to send a lot of money back. So the more money you give, the more you can maximize your gains, but the more money you give, the more at risk you are of someone just taking all of your cash, and you'd be better off just keeping hold of it. And finally, had a slightly more realistic measure, sort of in-game, where what participants were asked to do was to decide in what order they would bring people back in for interview. And they were told to bring back for interview first those people who they thought were maybe withholding information, not being cooperative, genuinely wouldn't be very difficult to get information from. So the idea was the people who just walked in and told them everything, they would come in last because you know they're going to help you as much as they can. Okay, this would have been a video to illustrate it. Sadly, it's not working. But the basic gist is this very nice Norwegian girl is going to keep asking this person who has knowledge questions. And the evil Dutch girl is just going to keep saying no and shrugging her shoulders and ignoring it. Okay, so into the results now, I believe. Once it gets past the video. Let me see. Okay, there we go. Okay, so looking at the extent of movement, essentially we got almost exactly what Sophie got. The people who were being deceived moved more. So this is exactly analogous to people who are deceiving also move more. So it looks like there might be some mirroring of that. The important thing for us, though, is that there was also some effect of knowledge. So the people who had no knowledge, that also caused people to be moving a little bit more. And the reason why this is quite interesting in terms of theory is that in that non-cooperative section here, the people who had the true knowledge in the black and the people who had no knowledge in the white had exactly the same response pattern. If you watch the videos, there's no real way of telling them apart. But there does seem to be a difference in terms of how much people are moving in those different conditions. So this helps us differentiate between this level being due to trust and just how much is just due to effort. Because if it was just due to effort, it would be this person isn't being cooperative, I'm going to be moving more. Whereas here, they're having to work just as hard, but there's still a difference in the movement. In terms of variability, we found almost the exact opposite of what you tend to observe in deceivers. The idea is that if you're deceiving, you have to have more than one view of the world in mind. This causes some difficulty when you're processing your movements and so on, so you tend to get more erratic, more shaky, more indecision. What we found is that people who were in a cooperative, friendly conversation, they had the more erratic movement. So I'm not entirely sure what that could be. It could just be that the people who are talking to somebody who's unpleasant are more on guard, they're feeling a bit more stiff, whereas those people who are having a friendly conversation, don't bother steady, those people in a friendly conversation are just feeling free to move around however they like. Okay. In terms of the explicit judgment, there's only a main effect of cooperation here. So people were able to identify that they were in a friendly conversation, but they weren't able to identify between different levels of knowledge. So all you can say really is, oh, this person's being nice to me, I like them more, therefore I trust them. However, you'll notice in both of our two measures, so the interview ranking on the right and the trust game on the left, there is something of a trend there where actually the people who were trusted least in the cooperative category were the people who were actually telling the truth. Now, I suspect this might be something to do with our experiment because in our particular case, what you've got, the truth tellers are the people who've been given a bunch of information and they're essentially giving a rehearsed story. Whereas the guys who are trusted the most, they're the ones who have just had a fake story sprung on them at the last minute. So they don't really have a rehearsed story. So this actually might be more what it's like when you're genuinely telling the truth, where you haven't really thought about planning what all of your answers are going to be. So it might just be that's an artifact of our experimental design. It might be something that's genuinely going on that will just need to be followed up somewhat a little bit more. So consciously, we've shown that people place more trust in cooperators and that this extra trust is reflected in movement. That extra movement does somewhat distinguish between the extra effort that is being put into these different conversations. It's not solely down to people being nice versus not being nice, because we have this effect where people who don't have knowledge also produce extra movement. We can't really say at the moment exactly why that is. It might just be because in our particular scenario, most people held knowledge and some people didn't. So it might be that those people are just a little bit weird. or it might just be that it might be genuinely something to do with people who do and don't hold knowledge that will just need to be replicated to find out more. And we also found more variable movement of cooperators. Like I say, again, that the theory of that requires a little bit more exploration, and it requires some replication as well, if anything. But it does seem that there is a difference there in terms of people who are deceiving and people who are being deceived. But essentially our initial plan panned out. You can seemingly detect some difference in the body movements of people who are being deceived. There's some slight inconsistency with the prior literature in terms of the total extent of movement. Sophie's basically explained this already. It seems to be largely the difference between counting the amount of movement when you're counting gestures versus the total amount of movement when you're looking at literally a sum of exactly how much is going on, including every small little fidget which may or may not be noticed when you're coding from a video. In terms of utility, the next stage we really need to go here, as well as replicating some of our findings and exploring the theory a little more, is we need to determine, can we actually see if this measurement is better than conscious judgment, as Sophie's already done with the measurement of behavior. We need to see whether being that extra layer away from the signal causes too much damage to the accuracy rate or not. And we also want to see if we can give people feedback based on their movement, will that improve judgment, so that then you're definitely getting the feedback between what you believe, what your movement is giving up. Does that allow you to then make a much more informed decision about whether or not you should trust the person? And that is it.